taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans. Welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad you could join me. You know, where every so often we're told that we need to give up or allow infringements on certain of our rights because, well, it's necessary. It's necessary to protect someone or something. And, well, in the latest example of this, Congress is attempting to convince you to give up your right to be secure from unreasonable searches, well, to keep you safe.
Benjamin Franklin said, "They who would give up essential liberty for temporary security deserve neither liberty or security." With the promise of keeping us safe from gun violence, violent extremists, and domestic terrorists, Congress wants you to give up your essential liberty to be free from unreasonable searches. H.R. 5764 is the first step to a writ of assistance against anyone who buys or sells firearms. This has been done before, so why shouldn't Congress think they can get away with it again? To understand the dangers of H.R. 5764, we need to understand a little bit of our history. One of the most intrusive abuses in the colonial era was the use of writs of assistance. The Free Legal Dictionary defines a writ of assistance as a writ authorizing officers of the British Crown to search any premises for smuggled goods. The idea of a writ of assistance is simple. Government actors would be given legal permission to search your premises for contraband without probable cause. If they found something, then they would fill out the warrant to seize what they have found. As James Otis put it in 1761, "I will to my dying day oppose with all the powers and faculties God has given me all such instruments of slavery on the one hand and villainy on the other hand as the writ of assistance is. It appears to me the worst instrument of arbitrary power, the most destructive of English liberty, and the fundamental principle of law that ever was found in an English law book." The idea of writs of assistance was so onerous that when the first Congress drafted the amendments that became our Bill of Rights, they specifically prohibited anything like them. The Fourth Amendment clearly states, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." The idea behind the Fourth Amendment is quite simple. You have a right to be secure from unreasonable searches. For a warrant to be issued to search your person, houses, papers, or effects, it must be based on probable cause and supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, someone has to go to court and swear or affirm that the information showing probable cause was true. Not only that, but any warrant issued must be specific in where people can search and what they can seize. In other words, the very concept of a writ of assistance is anathema to the rights protected by the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That, however, has not stopped Congress from authorizing writs of assistance in direct violation to their oath of office. Let's start with the Internal Revenue Service Code, Title 18, Section 7602 of the United States Code. Subsection A, authority to summon, etc. "For the purpose of ascertaining the correctness of any return, making a return where none has been made, determining the liability of any person for any internal revenue tax, or the liability at law or in equity of any transfer or fiduciary of any person in respect to any internal revenue tax, or collecting any such liability, the Secretary is authorized to, 1. The Secretary is authorized, 1. To examine any books, papers, records, or other data which may be relevant or material to such inquiry. 2. To summon the person liable for tax or required to perform the act, or any officer or employee of such person, or any persons having possession, custody, or care of books of accounts containing entries related to the business of the person liable for tax or required to perform the act, or any other person the Secretary may deem proper, to appear before the secretary at a time and place named in the summons, and to produce such books, papers, records, and other data, and to give such testimony under oath as may be relevant or material to such inquiry, and to take such testimony of the person concerned under oath as may be relevant or material to such inquiry. Whew, quite a list there. Congress passed a law supposing to give the Internal Revenue Service the authority to search your books, papers, records, or other data for the purpose of seeing if you filed your tax returns correctly. That means should you receive an audit notice from the IRS, they are seeking to search your records with an invalid warrant. Now, the Free Legal Dictionary defines a warrant as a written order issued by a judicial officer or other authorized person commanding a law enforcement officer to perform some act incident to the administration of justice. This law also claims to allow the IRS to summon you without probable cause, oath, or affirmation. The purpose of the summons is to take testimony under oath to determine if you have violated the IRS code. In other words, Congress has claimed the power to have the IRS issue invalid warrants, perform unreasonable and illegal searches, and to have you witness against yourself, which could be used against you later in a court of law. Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 7602, violates both the Fourth and Fifth Amendments to the U.S. Constitution in only one paragraph. Yet each year, thousands of Americans voluntarily submit to these illegal searches for fear of what the almighty IRS would do to them if they do not comply. And this is only the beginning. Title 31, Section 5313 of the United States Code reads, when a domestic financial institution involved in a transaction for the payment, receipt, or transfer of United States coins or currency or other monetary instruments the Secretary of the Treasury prescribes, in an amount, denomination, or amount and denomination, or under circumstances the Secretary prescribed by regulation, the institution and any other participant in the transaction the Secretary may prescribe shall file a report on the transaction at the time and in the way the Secretary prescribes. A participant acting for other persons shall make the report as the agent or bailee of the person and identify the person for whom the transaction is being made. This little piece of tyranny basically says the Secretary of the Treasury gets to tell banks and other financial or trading businesses to collect and report whatever information the Secretary may prescribe by regulation without probable cause. If you watch crime dramas, you've probably heard that banks are required to submit a suspicious activity report, or an SAR, to the government for every transaction of $10,000 or more. One of the things Congress tried to do was lower that threshold to just $600. While that attempt was defeated, the constitutional violation still exists. This law assumes that any transaction of $10,000 or more is not only suspicious, but probable cause that a crime may have been committed. I don't know if you've noticed, but the price of a car, a home, a motorcycle, land, and many other perfectly legitimate transactions are greater than $10,000. So the claim that any transaction of $10,000 or more is probable cause of a crime is offensive, ludicrous, and yet another violation of the oath of office every member of Congress took before assuming that office. And should you wish to comply with this law by conducting transactions in smaller amounts than need to be reported, you are charged with structuring transactions. So even if your transaction was perfectly legal, Congress considers it a crime to hide it from the federal government. Now with H.R. 5764, Congress wants to use the same writ of assistance technique to track firearm transactions. In general, no later than 1 year after the date of enactment of this act, FinCEN shall request information from financial institutions for the purpose of developing an advisory about the identification or reporting of suspicious activity relating to A, how homegrown violent extremists and perpetrators of domestic terrorism procure firearms and firearm accessories for the purpose of carrying out lone actor or lone wolf acts of terror within the United States, and B, the ways in which the firearms market in the United States is exploited to facilitate gun violence in the United States. This legislation doesn't demand reporting of transactions yet, but it is the first step toward doing so. It appears Congress wants to expand the definition of suspicious activities for financial institutions to report on, including what they think homegrown violent extremists and perpetrators of domestic terrorism might do to acquire firearms. The question that never seems to be asked in the legislation like this is, what makes a transaction suspicious, and what makes these transactions probable cause that a crime has been committed? For example, you may think buying 10,000 rounds of ammunition is suspicious. However, everyone from competitive shooters to people who are just looking for a bargain or just concerned about shortages may see this as a reasonable act to take. And if someone finds 10,000 rounds suspicious, what about 1,000 rounds or 100 or just 10? One day I was at a gun store and they had nice older rifles for sale. So I bought two, one for me and one for my father. Now, some people may see a person purchasing two rifles at the same time suspicious. Well, I was thinking it would be nice for my father and I to have identical rifles with consecutive serial numbers. And let's face it, if someone is planning to perpetrate some form of domestic terrorism, they're either going to buy their weapons on the black market or make sure their transactions are squeaky clean to avoid attracting attention. So the only real outcome of this attempt to develop a reporting system for suspicious activities related to firearms is further erosion of our right to be secure from unreasonable searches and potentially create another illegal federal firearm registry. Now, some of you may be thinking that if people don't have anything to hide, why are they worried about those in government checking their actions? While you may have nothing to hide, you do have everything to protect. As Benjamin Franklin said, if you are willing to give up essential liberties for the promise of temporary safety, you deserve neither. If you are willing to give up your right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures for either of these reasons, who will protect your rights when someone else comes up with an even more invasive reason? You may think it's reasonable for the government to poke around in your financial records to make sure you paid your taxes correctly. But what about making sure you pay your mortgage and credit cards on time? You may find a $10,000 transaction suspicious until you need to borrow money from a friend. And sure, you may think that your neighbor purchasing firearms and ammo are suspicious until the day the mob shows up and the only one who has the tools to protect you is that neighbor. The question shouldn't be whether someone thinks something is suspicious, but what are the requirements before government can go snooping around your stuff? Those in government claim that these laws are necessary to keep the people safe. Well, as William Pitt the Younger said, necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. The Constitution requires there be probable cause before you or your stuff can be searched. Not what a government bureaucrat thinks is suspicious or what your neighbor thinks is suspicious. The Constitution also requires that said probable cause be supported by oath or affirmation before a warrant is issued. Not legislation that demands you show people your books or that you show up and witness against yourself. Yet today, the government in Washington, D.C. has claimed the power to issue these writs of assistance, and we the people have given up our right to be secure against unreasonable searches in exchange for the promise that government will keep us safe. Because Mr. Franklin was right. The American people deserve neither liberty nor safety, and we will not deserve them again until we refuse to give up our rights every time someone in government claims it's to keep us safe or it's for our own good. Now, sadly, Americans used to be proud of our independence, our willingness, not simply our independence as in we declared independence from Great Britain, but our individual independence, the fact that we were not subjects of kings and queens and government, that we lived our lives with liberty and freedom for all. But that seems to have changed. And I saw this article. This actually came from America Out Loud, contributor Tom Weirman. I actually like the premise. I'm not going to quote too much from it, but the title is wonderful. Actually, let me read you the introductory paragraph because it says a lot. He starts out with, out of all of the despotic leaders the world currently has to offer, the winner might come from the one place no one would expect, the United States of America. And while Gavin Newsom and Lori Lightfoot would give stiff competition, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, formerly known as Warren Wilhelm, would undoubtedly come in first place and be crowned supreme leader. Now, again, I was born in New York City. I still have family that lives in New York City. I lived in the state of New York for most of my life. And then again, it was nonsense like this that drove me out of what was once my home state. Not specifically Mayor de Blasio, but what the state has become, this tyrannical group with despotic leaders in Albany, the state capital, along with New York and Buffalo and Rochester and some of the major cities. This idea that you're not allowed to think for yourself. You must be told what is the right answer for you. That the functional elite know better. And you must, the smelly, unwashed masses
must be forced to comply because, well, they just know better. Now, from the question of, well, we have to keep track of what you guys do because, well, you might be doing something wrong, to the requirement that, you know, of the lockdowns, to me, these all are on a spectrum that starts with the same basic concept. Are we free or not? Will we allow these assaults on our rights? Well, guess what? New York City, Chicago, and California sure have. The citizens of New York City elected Mayor de Blasio. Now, interesting enough, he's apparently term limited out. The person they've elected next seems to be a little less radical than Mr. de Blasio. Mayor Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, Governor Newsom in California, were both elected. Newsom was actually confirmed. He survived a recall election. The people of these cities and of the state of California will apparently want to be this way. They want their rights assaulted. Well, as long as it's not the rights that they really like. They're more than happy to assault their neighbors' rights, but they're not willing, you know, they may stand up if their own rights get assaulted, but they're not willing to stand up for their own rights. For example, in Illinois, you have a FOID card. There are several states that have what they're called fire owners ID cards, FOID cards. In other words, in those states, to own or possess a firearm, you need the state's approval. Now, that seems to be a basic infringement on the right to keep and bear arms, but courts all, you know, have upheld these laws over and over and over again. But that's not my point. See, they've been auditing the system, and according to auditors, they audited a sample of these requests. They found that 87% of FOID card requests were not processed in time. See, Illinois law says if you apply for a FOID card, the application must be processed within 30 days. See, and this is the creep that we run into. People will say, well, sure, it's an infringement, but you know what? It's not that big a deal. I mean, it's only 30 days. If you're a battered wife and you've taken out a restraining order against your husband and he or boyfriend and he keeps harassing you and he's threatening you and you wish to go get a gun to protect yourself, well, he'll obviously wait 30 days for the FOID application to come through. But then we find out that, you know what? 87% chance. 7 out of 8. You're not going to get your FOID card within that 30 days. In fact, you may wait up to a year. 60% of renewals took over 200 days. See, this is taking that, it'll only be 30 days. It's not that big a deal. But you see, then it pushes. It's the whether you call it the slippery slope argument, the camel nose under the tent argument. It is the progression towards chaos. It is entropy that these systems get delayed and your rights further and further and further erode. Not to be outdone, Governor Gavin Newsom, he's pitching a hissy fit. He's doing everything but dropping on the floor in a full-blown toddler temper tantrum. You see, he doesn't like the fact that the Supreme Court has not put an injunction against, he's not enjoined anybody from enforcing Texas's pro-life law while it's going through the court. Now, if there are two things that Governor Newsom has shown to truly despise, it's anything that restricts abortion and anything that allows you to exercise your right to keep and bear arms. Just look at the laws in California that he has had a hand in putting in place. So since he doesn't like the way the Supreme Court is allowing the courts to deal with this, And quoting Governor Newsom, "I am outraged by yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision allowing Texas's ban on most abortion services to remain in place and largely endorsing Texas's scheme to insulate its law from the fundamental protections of Roe v. Wade." All right. And again, the court was asked to enjoin the law. The court said it cannot enjoin the law for two reasons. One, it does not enjoin laws. It enjoins people from exercising, from enforcing the law. So there is no person for them to enjoin at this point because the law is specifically written so that it's private citizens that sue abortionists, not the government. So there's no government defense. And the person in the case, they said, listen, he may not even, have standing because he's not the case isn't against someone actually suing. But you see, he doesn't care about that. All he cares is that he wanted the court to stop this, and they didn't. The fact that they had no legal grounds to do so, the fact that Texas wrote the law to satisfy the court's opinion in Roe v. Wade doesn't matter. He refers to them. He refers to the fundamental protections of Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade does not contain fundamental protections. It is an opinion of a court. It is not law. It is not supreme law. It is a bloody opinion. So what does he say in his statement? Going back to Governor Newsom, "But if states can now shield their laws from review by federal courts that compare assault weapons to Swiss Army knives, then California will use that authority to protect people's lives where Texas used to put women's in harm's way." Well, again, get up off the floor, Mr. Newsom. It doesn't say that states can shield their laws from review. It said that the states actually designed the law to comply with the current opinion of the court. And that is what's being reviewed by the courts right now. But you see, he doesn't want that because he's a petty tyrant. He wants his way. So he says, well, here's what we're going to do. He refers to assault weapons. Now, assault weapons is a scary made-up term. It's what's called an assault rifle. But understand, assault is a verb. It is an action. You can use a baseball bat as an assault baseball bat. You can use a motor vehicle as an assault car. There is no true definition of assault weapons. What most people try to refer to is a semi-automatic weapon that looks scary. And yes, the infamous AR-15, the poster child for quote-unquote assault weapons, is referred to as a Swiss Army knife, not because of its lethality, but because of its customizability and flexibility, its ease of use. So what he wants California to do is supposedly protect lives by denying people the tools that can best be used to protect their lives, in a claim that Texas is harming women. What Texas is actually doing is saving the life of, among other things, unborn females, unborn girls, unborn women. This is, we'll come after your rights. We don't like the outcome, so we'll come after your rights. And if we don't get our way, well, we'll just find another way to do it. This is just one of many examples of these petty tyrants in these states using their position to infringe on your rights to do what they think is best to keep you safe, even though the evidence is that they not only cause more harm than good, they're actually dangerous to the very people they claim to be wanting to protect. In an interesting example, Beverly Hills is known for the lives of the rich and famous, movie stars, very opulent. Well, the Beverly Hills firefighters are now suing over these COVID-19 quote-unquote vaccine mandates. See, they're suing Los Angeles County and the city of Beverly Hills, alleging that the healthcare worker coronavirus mandate should be declared void because the city has no authority to question the religious exemptions to the mandate. Now, the firefighters are not alone. There's another organization called the Protection for Education Rights of Kids, or PERC, and they, along with the Beverly Hills firefighters, are suing. Now, the interesting thing is the city responded, or at least a representative of the city, said that while we've not seen the lawsuit, the city remains committed to protecting the health of our residents and visitors during the ongoing pandemic, or during this ongoing pandemic. Except if you look at the data, the vaccines really haven't stopped the spread of the coronavirus. But understand, this is the city of Beverly Hills saying that we know better than everyone else. Now, part of me could understand that says, you know what, people are not going to visit Beverly Hills if our first responders aren't vaccinated. But you see, that's not the claim that I'm seeing. No, the city says, listen, we know better, and the best way to deal with this is to force everyone to get vaccinated, regardless of the health of the person being vaccinated, regardless of the necessity of the person being vaccinated, regardless of the impact to those who are residents and visitors of the city. See, there are plenty of studies that show that while there may be a couple of months of protection against the effects of COVID-19, people who are quote unquote vaccinated can still get the disease. And when they get the disease, they can still spread the disease. So this really falls on somewhat deaf ears. And again, this is a disease that most Americans have a 99%+ chance of surviving. But it also ignores the fact that the people who are residents and who are visitors, they have a choice, right? Visitors at least have a choice. Now, residents, again, I suppose a resident could request a first responder be vaccinated. I know several people that have healthcare workers that come to visit. They get home treatment and they require that that person be vaccinated. That's their choice. But you see, it's not the argument of the city that it would have as an employee, it would have an adverse impact on the city. No, no, no. This is, we know better than everybody else. Therefore, we're going to force everybody to comply with our wishes. We're going to take away your liberty, well, because we think we know better how to protect us from a pandemic that truly isn't a pandemic. It's endemic, yes, but to call this truly a pandemic is really, really a stretch, because it's been fairly contagious, yes, but it has certainly not been deadly. Yes, thousands of people have died. And yes, according to the CDC, as many as 94% of them died with COVID, not of COVID, at least in the United States. But if you're willing to trade your right to be at liberty, your essential right of liberty, for the promise that the city or the state or the federal government will keep you safe, you don't deserve either. At least that's what Benjamin Franklin said. He would give up essential liberties for the promise of temporary safety deserves neither. Neither liberty nor safety. If you want to be safe, it is up to you to keep yourself safe. As soon as you delegate that power to somebody else, you become their subject. You become a slave to their opinions. And sadly, that's where many Americans seem to be today. Now, I have to take a quick break, but before I do, a couple of reminders. One, head to constitutionstudy.com. Find out all about the Constitution Study, the work that we're doing, the places I'll be speaking. Sign up for the newsletter or for the live Q&A session I hold twice a month. Or just ask a question. Click the ask a question. You can have me answer it directly, or you can have me answer it here on the radio. All of that's there for you to use. All of that's there for you to share. And all of that there is absolutely free. Also, please head over to healthycell.com/outloud. You know, we're talking about health. And there's a lot of things you can do to help keep yourself from getting COVID, the flu, the cold, a lot of things by living a healthy lifestyle that makes sure you get the right vitamins and minerals your body needs. Healthy Cell has reinvented the vitamin, and whether it's the immune super booster, just like me, sometimes you need that focus and recall. You need that little extra, and you reach for the energy drink. Well, ignore the caffeine, ignore the sugar. try Healthy Cells Focus and Recall. And as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order by going to healthycell.com/outloud. That's healthycell.com/outloud for 20% off your first order.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is McCullough Report. Are you tired of your tired vitamins? Consider Healthy Cell. These are pill-free vitamins that are in convenient gel packs. I like the Focus and Recall supplement. I use this a lot. You know, your brain uses a lot of energy, and it depends on a variety of micronutrients and vitamins. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus and Recall vitamins. So go to healthycell.com, use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any Healthy Cell product. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health four times a day. That's 112 times per month. But by simply keeping our immune system strong, we can stay healthy and put our worries at ease. One little known way to do this is by taking AC11, a patented supplement from a plant in the Amazon rainforest. Studied for over 20 years and backed by over 40 scientific peer-reviewed studies, taking AC11 has been proven to extend the life of immune cells called leukocytes, allowing you to boost immunity naturally. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of AC11. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
It was a vision that gave birth to a unique multimedia platform that would combine classic talk radio, great writers, and memorable podcasts and videos. AmericaOutLoud.com is a conservative leader in a field that is predominantly run by far-left progressive globalists. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. I'm glad you could join me here. We are reading and studying the Constitution at the Constitution Study. I spent the first half of the program talking about the trading of our rights for a promise of safety, for the attempts by tyrants in the United States at the state and city level, and of course it's also at the federal level, to claim the power to infringe on your rights because they know better than you do. Their job is to keep you safe. I'm asked that question. What are we supposed to do? How does government keep us safe without infringing on our rights? Well, there's the first problem. Government's job isn't to keep you safe. Government's job is to protect your rights. So the first thing we have to do is recognize, let government protect your rights. You figure out how to keep yourself safe. But no, we're not allowed to do that. You know, I was talking to someone the other day about why we left New York State. Well, it's because of stuff like this. See, the new governor, Kathy Hochul, announced that that she's going to require masks on indoor public places unless the business implements a vaccine requirement. Now, I'm beating a dead horse, but legally, constitutionally, she has no authority to force a private organization either to implement a mask mandate or to have a mask or a vaccine mandate. These are all illegal, unconstitutional. These are federal crimes. And sometimes I feel like, you know, a lone voice in the wilderness going, you realize, people, these are crimes. This is a violation of federal law. But no one seems to care. No one seems to be pushing back. No one certainly seems to be charging them. And let's be honest, I doubt the U.S. Attorney's Office would actually prosecute. But this is what comes when we allow these assaults on our rights, when we allow petty tyrants to claim the authority to tell you when and where you'll be allowed to exercise your rights, to act above the law, outside of the Constitution, and get away with it. You know, Kathy Hochul replaced Governor Cuomo, who was removed for accusations of, well, let's say sexual assault and misconduct. Here we have criminal activity. No one's talking about removing her. Now, I'm sure there are people in New York State that are none too happy about this, but will they stand up and say enough is enough? No, how would you like me to prove to you that this is void? It's empty. It's meaningless. Because it really is simple. We start with Alexander Hamblin in Federalist Paper number 78, where he says, "There is no position which depends on clearer principle than that every act of a delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void." Now, that's real simple, right? Every act of a delegated authority, every act of government is a delegated authority. We delegate power to governments in the United States. We create them via the Constitution. Since we did not delegate to the state of New York, at least the citizens of the state of New York, did not delegate the authority of to the governor to simply demand private businesses give up control of their businesses, that the people give up their liberty when the government says so, that act is void. But it's not just that. The Supreme Court of the United States, in the case Marbury versus Madison, in that opinion, wrote, "Thus, the particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle supposed to be essential to all written constitutions, that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void, and that courts, as well as other departments, are bound by that instrument." Ms. Hochul is issuing something under color of law that is repugnant to the Constitution. It deprives you of your liberty and your property without due process of law. It is therefore void. And the court should simply ignore it. It is empty and meaningless. And other departments should as well. Sadly, that's not what's happening. We've been cowed into believing that government can do whatever government says it can do. But you see, we created government. And the sad part is, you know, I was answering a question earlier today about the purpose of government. And part of it is understanding that we created government. We gave it powers. We said, here's your boundary. But we stopped enforcing it. And we started looking for government to take care of everything, especially the federal government. Looking to the federal government to take care of everything. So I found an article under Just the News in which a watchdog group called Open the Books found widespread misspending of pandemic relief funds by schools. You see, there was $190 billion, with a B, billion dollars in pandemic relief funding under both the Trump and the Biden administration that were allocated specifically to schools to safely reopen and protect both the teachers and the parents. Yet Open Books found things like Crescent, Iowa, expanded their sports stadium and spent $231,000 to add bleachers. In Kentucky, they replaced a track using these relief funds. The Kentucky project used $1 million in federal elementary and secondary school relief funds to replace a track. And there's more. Boston upgraded its athletic field with supposedly pandemic relief funds. Irwin, Tennessee spent millions upgrading athletic fields. One school was looking to fund a new gymnasium. One set of tennis courts off of what are supposedly to be COVID pandemic relief fund, relief dollars. Now, why do I bring this up? Because it's the problem we run into with the federal government simply throwing money at a problem and there's not enough oversight. See, now, if these states or these cities had allocated funds for making schools safer for teachers and students during this quote-unquote pandemic, well, then the local people would have kept a lot closer eye on what's going on. But see, here we turn around. We get people patting themselves on the back. We spent $190 billion of your money to keep people safe, to keep to safely reopen schools and to keep students and teachers safe. Yet, when you look at the details, you find out that some percentage of that was used for something else, which begs two important questions. One, how much? How much of your money was embezzled? Yes, embezzled, used for a purpose other than it was designed for. And then, who's being held accountable for it? See, those questions need to be answered, but not enough people are answering them. They're not even asking them. All they see is politicians saying, listen, we spent $190 billion. No, you didn't pay $100. You stole $190 billion for something we had not authorized you to do. And then you sent it and allowed it to be squandered, or at least a percentage of it to be squandered. That to me is not the work of a good employee. That to me is the work of a lazy and self-centered employee. And while we're talking about the misuse of our tax dollars and our policies, you know, I've been hearing for so long that we've got this push towards electric vehicles. We've got to have, was it Pete Buttigieg said, when we get to an all-electric vehicles, people won't worry about gas prices. Kind of forgets that then they have to worry about electric prices. But that we're not going to worry about that, because electric vehicles they're wonderful. They're going to save the planet. You know, everybody's going to be healthy and happy once we get to electric vehicles, never asking a couple of simple questions. Question number one, where's the electricity come from? You see, most people don't understand is electricity is not a store of energy. It's a transmission of energy. There's not like electricity mines they go to. They have to do something to get the electricity. But here's the other problem we have with all these electric vehicles, and that is the technology we currently use in the batteries and other parts that make a vehicle electric, well, they come from somewhere. I found this article, I've actually read it in the Tennessee Star, I think it comes from the Daily Caller. One of the things that they need a lot of for electric vehicles is nickel. So they need to mine nickel use it in different part of the manufacturing. It's one of a bunch of minerals. Enter the Rio Tuba mine in the region of Palawan in the Philippines. See now, this mine, the Rio Tuba mine, mines many of the important minerals that are necessary for the creation, for the batteries that go in electric cars like the Tesla or your hybrid car like the Toyotas. See, part of what they've done is they have grown from just 4 square miles to over 14 square miles. That means they have deforested 10 square miles, according to an NBC News investigation. See, as the mine grows, they have to, clear-cut forests for the mine. So that brand-new electric vehicle or hybrid vehicle you're so proud of, are you proud of the deforestation that went to gather the minerals necessary to make that happen? Oh, and don't forget, there's more, because also according to the news report, many critics suggest that there are toxic waste that is part of the mining process. Yeah, you're mining all this stuff. You have toxic materials, that need to be dealt with. So while everybody's going, yay, electric vehicles, because in America, in your backyard, there's zero emissions. But what about the electric plant? You see, you don't want nuclear because we got scared to death by the Three Mile Island in Chernobyl. Forget the fact that there are better ways of doing it. People don't want nuclear power in their backyard. They say we'll do wind and solar, forgetting the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine, and they require some sort of fossil fuel backup, which means we're burning natural gas, but they don't like natural gas. They're shutting down natural gas pipelines because that's a fossil fuel. making us even more dependent on things like oil and coal, older plants that we can't retire because they won't let us because a conversion to natural gas is either too expensive or too much hung up in regulatory red tape. And now you can be participating in the deforestation of places like the Philippines, and potentially the poisoning of the land with the toxic processes, the waste products of the process of mining and refining. Now, I'm not saying electric vehicles are bad. There certainly is a place for them. But when we make these grand decisions without all the facts, when we never ask the second and third order question, when we never ask, and then what? We make ourselves feel better because we think we've done something without recognizing the damage that we've done. Now, I have no problem with moving to different forms of energy. If you can find a form of energy that is more efficient, less expensive, and less harmful, some combination of those things, well, I'm all for it. But the problem is we're not letting these companies, these industries develop that. We've got the federal government saying, no, you must do this. You must push electric vehicles. What about the damage electric vehicles do to the environment? Well, no. You got to do electric vehicles. That's what we've decided. That you must use solar and wind. Well, what about things like, I don't know, thorium reactors? No. You can't do that. We're not allowed. See, the biggest problem is when in allowing government to federal government to illegally spend money. That's right. Illegally. It is a crime for the federal government to, quote unquote, invest in new technologies that's not authorized by the Constitution of the United States. See, all that's authorized is Congress is authorized to promote progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right of their respective writings and discoveries. The only role the federal government, the United States, has in science and arts is patents and copyrights. That's it. But you see, we've let the federal government just tell us they're going to invest. No, they're going to steal from you. They're going to embezzle from you to pick winners and losers and not allow competition. So everyone's having a conniption about big tech and there's no competition. Where's the competition in the development of new technologies when the federal government places its thumb on the scale and says, we're going to support these and we're going to impede others? Of course, that's not all. Back on December 9th, Joe Biden announced he's going to use your money, that's right, your money, to fund media outlets throughout the world. We call that, it's called propaganda. Now, he says it's to support freedom of the press. I'm sorry, but if you're funding somebody, that's not freedom of the press. He who pays the piper calls the tune. Now, could the federal government, as part of its foreign relations, encourage a more free press in other countries? Yes. But we didn't authorize the United States to spend money to promote media outlets. We didn't fund it to promote freedom of the press globally. We didn't tell it to take our tax money and fund these outlets. But this is not freedom of the press. And he says it's part of his initiative for democratic renewal. No. First of all, we're not a democracy. But do you really think if the federal government, well, let me put it this way. The federal government says it has to use foreign aid to influence other countries to change, right? That's the whole justification for spending billions of dollars sending them to foreign countries because we want to encourage them to change, to act in a way we think is better. Well, then what's the purpose of sending that money to media outlets? Because we want them to change. We want them to act in a way that we find beneficial. So if the United States is supporting a newspaper, a television, radio, whatever, overseas, isn't that to influence their reporting? Now, that may not be President Biden's intention. It may not even be something that President Biden would do. But somebody will. Sooner or later, somebody will use this money, the threat of removal of this funding, to influence the news in another country. Now, you may like what they're influencing it for, you may dislike it, but sooner or later, someone will not only use it, they'll use it in a way that you find despicable. But if we let the federal government do this, if we the people allow our employees in the government of the United States to break the law and to act in such a criminal way without any consequence, we'll have no one to blame when this propaganda is used to turn foreign influence against us, against our rights, against our liberties. We will have paid for it. And while we're speaking about paying for things, I remember many years ago, my wife and I were at a friend's house. We having coffee after dinner or something. I don't remember. One of them was very upset. She was couldn't believe that the federal government was actually going to make her pay back her student loan. Now, I was her guest. I didn't say anything, but I never forget that night. Because to me, it was the quintessential viewpoint of irresponsibility. You borrowed money, you agreed to pay, you promised to pay it back. And whether or not you agree with should it be forgiven or not, you promised. How can you be upset that someone's actually asking you to keep your promise? Now, that was many, many, many years ago. But this idea still exists. See, we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I still say she's the perfect example of better to keep your mouth shut and be thought a fool than to open your mouth and prove it. She's complaining because at age 32, she still owes over $17,000 in student loan debt. She says, I didn't go to graduate school because I knew that getting another degree would drown me in debt and I'd never be able to surpass. So what does she want you to do? She wants you to pay her $17,000 in student loan debt. Well, she doesn't put it that way. No, she says she wants it forgiven. In other words, she wants the American people to eat the $17,000 she owes them in a student loan debt. Now, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, as a member of Congress, has a taxpayer-funded salary of $174,000 a year. That is over twice the average annual income in the United States. Not to mention, that's just her salary. Not to mention, she also gets money for to pay for her office, to pay for travel, to pay. She gets more than just $174,000. That's the point I'm trying to make. Now she's got $17,000 in student loan debt. That is 10% of 1 year of her salary. And she's whining and crying, complaining. She wants the American people, the majority of which make a vastly lower income, to pay off her loan for her. You know what? She's all about tax the rich. I have a great idea. I think Ms. Ocasio-Cortez should be required every year she's in office to pay $17,000 of someone else's student loan debt. How does that sound, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez? This is the worst type of self-indulgent greed I can think of. You make $174,000. First of all, you signed on the dotted line. You entered into a contract to pay this student loan, to take this student loan, to pay it back. You owe the money. It is immoral for you to ask someone else to pay it for you. It is immoral to ask people less off than you do. You, who claim to champion the poor person, want poor people to pay off your loan. You hypocrite. This is nothing but a greedy, whiny socialist, Marxist. She makes, again, $174,000 a year. She can't afford a student loan debt. When I married my wife, she had student loan debt. You know what we did? We paid it off. It took years to pay it off, but we did. Because we believed that when we promised, when she promised to pay off that loan, that when I married her, I assumed that responsibility as well. Now, she's not the only one. The quote-unquote husband of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, he doesn't seem to be too happy about having to pay back his student loan debt either. You have people making hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mr. Buttigieg makes I don't know what he makes, but he makes a pretty good salary. And he can't afford to pay off his husband's student loan debt. You greedy. That's the word for it. Gloves off. Greedy. You make enough money to pay off that. You promise to pay off that debt. You make more than enough money. These people aren't going hungry. They're not looking for a place to live. They make more than enough money to pay off their student loan debt. The fact that they want you, the American people, to do it proves what I've been saying about socialists all along. The few get extremely rich on the backs of the poor. I don't care what their rhetoric is. You look at any socialist country, you've got an elite few that are rich, and they do so on the backs of the poor. That's why I say don't pay attention to what they say. Look at what they do. And you know what these people do? These are greedy, spoiled brats. I think what they need is not to have their loans paid off, but I think they need to be taken out back and spanked. Grow up. Whiny, little, greedy children. Now, America Out Loud Talk Radio plays on the iHeartRadio Network. You can listen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from any web browser anywhere in the world. Try our best-in-class apps on Apple, Android, and Alexa. And now you can listen to the podcast on the apps as well. Listen to previous episodes of the Constitution Study or any of the America Out Loud programs and help learn to secure the blessings of liberty.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail.